accession number 18439, Reel 3.
It's Reel 3.
Yes, the number went up to 25 a day. Some people would argue that it went greater, but that was the maximum number that I personally ever saw. And we had to get a grip of the sanitation situation in the camp. There were only wells to supply the fresh water. The Chinese insisted that everyone what drunk water had to drink boiled water, which were a good thing. But there were also plenty of spring water about coming out of the hillside, looked quite clean, and that caused a lot of problems because we all used to drink it thinking we were all right. And everybody got dysentery. Everybody got dysentery. I would say the number of people what died, of British people what died in the camp, was down to about 10 out of 600, but with the Americans. When we came out of that camp, there were only 1,400 people came out of that camp, but we were well over 2,000 when we went into it. So the number of Americans died was could be in anything from 500 to 600.
How did the guards treat you though?
Well, the guards had nothing at all to do with it. There were no point, there were nowhere to run to, in as much that to break out, they didn't need, we weren't surrounded by barbed wire, we were surrounded by mountains and by Korean people who had no time for us whatsoever, and so we'd nowhere to go to. We didn't even walk like the Chinese or even walk like the Koreans. It was just a futile exercise to break out. One could have walked out of the camp any time of the day or night if it wouldn't have been so inclined. But the distance to travel in order to get food was just out of this world, beyond conception. One or two chaps did try, made gallant attempts, but they used to take bets, well, they'd be back in 3 days, and they wouldn't come back in 3 days. They'd be caught by the Korean police and the likes of them, treated quite harshly. And then they'd be brought back. The camp took some adapting to it, in as much that we didn't get rice at the beginning. They tried all sorts of things. We had boiled millet. We had sorghum instead of rice. Now that's a horrible thing. It's like pearl barley, absolutely tasteless. And their idea of giving you good food, they would make a point of once a week giving us pig. Now it would be a small pig, it would be walked down to the slaughterhouse, which was just a little village house, and the Chinese man would kill it, cut its throat, and he'd chop it up into little bits the size of an Oxo cube, and if one prisoner of war got one lump, he was a lucky man. And it was all put in a built cauldron and cooked collectively and then shared out to each section of 10 men. The Chinese segregated us and put us into sections of 10 men. We were 10 men to a room, 8 foot by 8 foot. And there were all Korean houses that we lived in this town of Cheongsong. And they took off. By this time, with the long march, we were run with lice, which were our biggest enemy. And also the people who had army shirts. Lice seemed to find habitation in army shirts, and especially in woolen sweaters. And we just couldn't get shut of them. So the Chinese had a blitz on them, and they brought in big cauldrons, and we boiled. The only way you can kill a louse is to boil all your clothes for 20 minutes and put them out to dry. It took many weeks, it took many months to get shut of lice, but we finally did. We had to defeat the lice before the lice defeated us. The one thing that kept us alive and was more responsible than anything else in sustaining life in that camp was the soya bean. And the soya bean was something that we always had for breakfast. Soya beans, it's just like it's a bit harder than a Heinz, but what one call a haricot bean. And it was soaked, and we used to have soya beans for breakfast. And when I say soya beans, each man would have a little tin, no bigger than that mug, and he would just get 2 spoons of beans, no more, per man. Each squad of 10 men had only one possession, and it was a green bowl. And that green bowl went to the cookhouse every morning at breakfast time. One man was selected out of the 10 men to be the squad leader, the other man to be the writer, and you each took it in turn every morning, every meal time, to go with the green tin to the cookhouse for your squad's ration of side dish for the day, for the side dish for that meal. And you also got about a mugful of rice, no more. But when soya beans run out, the deterioration of the health of the men were alarming. But once soya beans were there, they were so life-giving, you might say, that it was wonderful. For the amount of food we ate all the time that we were there for 2.5 years, the condition we came out in was wonderful, considering what we were given to eat. But the problem was that it was the soya bean which sustained us more than any other commodity that we ate that were given at all.
Did you have any festivities like Christmas or anything?
Yes,
like that?
They allowed us to enjoy Christmas. We had an extra side dish at Christmas. By side dish, if there was cabbage for one little side dish, and they might bring on a few potatoes or a bit of meat, more likely meat. And if we got 2 side dishes, that were a festival. And then in January, late January, they always celebrated Chinese New Year, which was, they called, the Spring Festival. And in late January, beginning of February, we also had this second festival. And Mid-Autumn Festival in August, September time was celebrated because it was regarded as the harvest time for peasant people. We also celebrated the October Revolution because, after all, we were communists. They started indoctrination in about August, September 1951. Now, indoctrination, it was political indoctrination. What they did, they brought in educated Chinese people, very fluent in English. Each company had a good English speaking instructor, 2 instructors in fact sometimes, and they would deliver a lecture on the feudal system, the capitalist system. We studied the Finnish War, Russian-Finnish War, the difference between communism and socialism, and many subjects like that. And they will break it down into economics. Every time, economics is the basis of everything in the communist way of life. And then they would sit us in rings of 10 men, and we would have to discuss this question. Then the writer would in turn put down Rifleman Tyus, answer to his question, blah blah blah. Rifleman King, so and so, his answer, so and so. And then these papers were taken up to the company headquarters, and the political man would then study what you'd written, and then he'd come back at night and say, come to his office, and he would say, why did you say this was the reason for that? Well, so and so and so and so. Right, tell Private Fitzpatrick to come up, and I want to speak to him too. And everybody would be interrogated on a daily basis to answer questions about the things which we've been studying, which were the difference between the two systems. They had a fetish about the American system and the capitalists such as DuPont and the likes of, and these warmongers and the peace-loving people of the world. And They put great store on the peace-loving people of the world, stopping the Korean War. We were also fed lots of information about the peace talks. You see, the peace talks started in July 1951 and went on for 2 years and 3 months. They went on for a total of 2 years.
When you gave your answers, did you answer as you really felt or as you thought they wanted to hear?
Well, it wasn't as easy as that. It was not a question of conflict. It was a question of making you politically aware of what were happening in your own country and also what were happening in the world at large. There was nothing sinister about it. There's nothing sinister to be gained. Our systems were totally different. But the new system to the Chinese gave them something which they'd never had. We had to study their agrarian reform and how they took over and how the communists had gone and disposed of the landlord, and they'd made a great deal of burning the title deeds and then sharing the land out with the peasants, giving them an interest which they'd never had before, because they'd been subject to great oppression than the Chinese people. So much that we were not aware of it. But then they were not aware of our history. But they could find arguments, and they just wanted to discuss the systems in each country. And they pointed out the oppression under which they considered we working in mills were all under oppression. They didn't realise we had a freedom which they didn't have. And one could get locked into great debates with them. They liked nothing else better. But then it were a method of passing the day. Our next most important occupation was the fact that we could not survive without fuel. And it was necessary for the fuel, with the construction of the houses. Each house had a little cooking spot and two major rooms, each room being 8 foot wide. Now, the cooking area at the bottom contained three set pots. Two main pots, two bigger and one little one. Now then, all the floors were raised up in these houses, and one fire would be lit to cook the food in these houses, and the three flues run under each floor. Converters at the end went up, so we had, in order to survive in temperatures of minus 50 centigrade, we had to make a daily trip to the hill. And they ordered wood detail for us from day one. We all had to go to the hill. There were great forests. We had to find decayed trees and the like. So, and each man had to bring 28 catties. 28 catties were about 50 pounds in weight, and we all had to bring a log back, because the whole system could not evolve without fuel. Neither could we survive. We would have been frozen to death. They took the old army gear from us in the first summer, and they issued us with cotton, clean cotton food, underwear, and blue trousers, and a coat, and an overcoat. In the winter, in November, this was taken from us, and they issued us with K-pack paddock clothes, which was a great help in the severe weather of minus 50. And these K-pack paddock clothes were stuffed with cotton, double lined, and half an inch thick, quarter thick. And the main reason we did survive because of that paddock clothing. It was superior to what we in the British Army had had. But then we weren't running about in slit trenches.
Were you ever punished yourself as a POW?
Well, there was only one time when sometimes the guards may not be able to understand the language of English, but they can understand attitude. And I had one reason one time to be quite venomous to the guard, and I used foul language to him, but he knew my attitude were bad, so he reported me to the instructor, and I was just thrown in a hole for 3 days, which were full of logs. And it's very difficult trying to sleep on logs without anything. And they came to me, they fed me. And then they came to me and said, would I criticise myself? And so I was given the option of saying I was sorry to the peace-loving people of the world and the Chinese People's Liberation Army, and I would alter my attitude to be a better student. I had to read this out. Everybody were laughing at the company and the company meeting, because the company were always drawn together, and the company commander giving a talk every night, and he spouted on Chinese, and the instructor would then convert to English and say, "Now then, chaps, you've not done too well today. You didn't fetch enough wood back. You'll have to book up," and the likes of. And they'll have a better attitude out of everybody to fetching wood and also paying attention to the lectures. And this was a nightly effort.
But what had upset you in the first place?
Well, I was having trouble with bubbly guts and diarrhoea, and I didn't want to do any PT. They insisted on PT every morning. They got our PT instructors out to make us do a few silly exercises. And, I told him to go away. I wasn't going to do any exercises. And they said, "Dias, take action." So I told him to F off. And he said, "Your attitude's very bad." So they threw me in the hole, but that's the way it was.
Were you getting any news from the outside world?
Yes, we got news from the outside world. In the starting about June, July in 1951, we used to get the London Daily Worker, and it was always 3 months out of date. And they're great believers in wall newspapers, and they pinned it on the wall newspaper situation, and they would then turn it over in 3 days, and we would read the back page. And so there were always two double pages on show, and we read about it, because in 1951, was it 52, there were Olympics in Helsinki. Yes, it would be 52. And we watched all the Olympics on the Daily Worker, on the London Daily Worker. Yes, we got some good information. I remember quite well in April 1953, it would be, we were aware from that the coronation was coming up, and we also were informed through the Daily Worker that there'd been a horrendous flood in Lynmouth. And so what we all decided it was to send £3 of our wages to Lynmouth flood disaster. Oh, they said these letters won't get through. We weren't sure that letters were getting known, but we were getting a few scant letters coming through to our camp, and from home. They were told where to write to our home, and we sent letters on to them, but not a lot got home. Anyway, the idea was that we'd all get together and send £3 of our wages to the Lynmouth flood, and it got home. When we were released, we were given a paybook, and the first entry in the paybook was a £3 donation to the Lynmouth flood disaster, which took place in about February 1953. I do believe. Yes, we got quite a bit of information from home. We also had a visit. We had visits. Now, these were incredible. There were communist English people who were the correspondent for the Daily Worker. One man's name was Alan Winnington. Mr. Winnington was a correspondent for the Daily Worker. And also, there was an Australian man by the name of Wilfred Burchett. And Burchett was the Australian correspondent for a French paper called Ce Soir. I don't know what that means, the truth or something like that. And we were given lectures by Burchett. Came and gave us two. He informed us about what was happening at home. At first the men booed him because they regarded him as a traitor. And when we first went to see Winnington, it was quite a man, were Winnington. We didn't know what to do to upset him. So as the men, 150 men, marched onto the square to listen to Mr. Alan Winnington, everybody broke out in the same song, and we sang him "The Land of Hope and Glory." Winnington stood there, and the men finished off us, rousing "Land of Hope and Glory." And he said, "Wonderful chaps," and he clapped us. He says, "And I want you to know, it's my land of hope and glory as well as yours. I am here to report life on the wrong side of the parallel. He says, and don't forget it, I only speak the truth. What happens on this side? It is important for people to know in England, not just the American account of what happens on the south side. With that, we were all gobsmacked. But our retaliation, our only thing we could do to show him our disgust was to sing him the Land of Hope and Glory.
Any reaction from Wilfred Burchett?
No, we didn't treat Burchett with the same disdain because he was Australian and he was quite a pleasant fella. There was just no point with Burchett. One camp farther up the road, 40 miles away, was visited by a lady called Monica Felton. She was a famous lady of the peace committees of the 50s and 51s, and she was a councillor for Stevenage in London. She never came to our camp, but we were visited by a solicitor in November 1951 by the name of Jack Gaster, Caster or Gaster, G-A-S or C-A-S, and he was from an international section of lawyers. And he'd come down to see the atrocities committed by American troops in Pyongyang when they were on the advance up. And he only spoke to a selected number of men in our camp. We had, the Chinese made us elect democratically a peace committee. And each company, there were three companies of British men, Company 5, 6 and 7, of which I was in Company 6, each 5, 6 and 7 elected a man to the peace committee, and the American companies did the same. And these men sat every week to decide what things could be done to improve our daily life. Because your daily life in those situations was the most important thing that could happen to you. If any ideas that anyone had, as regards cooking the food, or what things could be done to improve life in general. That's where I, at the back end of the our time in that camp, that's where I came into my own. I dug extra trenches for the toilet, because being a trained sanitary engineer, and I designed a toilet, well designed, it's real ridiculous. Everybody in Korea never wasted night soil. Human night soil was the only thing that they had to feed the land and the vast rice paddies. So each house, no matter where they were in Korea, saved its night soil to put back to the land. And I was the first in our camp. I built in a big outside toilet because they had a fetish for destroying flies. Sounds ridiculous. We were once, I'm breaking off my story, but it's vital for you to understand that they made a rule that every man in our camp would kill 40 flies a day. They even issued and brought fly swatters. Men would issue with fly swatters, and they would kill 40 flies. And everybody, even right up to the camp commander, at every Chinese on our camp, and every man in the Chinese army, every day of his working life, he killed 40 flies. But British lad being what they were, and the Chinese being so naive, we killed, for the first few days, we killed our 40 flies. And each man queued up with his little tin with the 40 flies in and took them to the company office he counted about, and they threw them out the window. And the lads would go round the back and collect the bloody flies, and then they hadn't another 40 flies to kill. Until it was finally abolished after a month. It was ridiculous. But the number of flies they killed were phenomenal. And the idea was to create a toilet which was completely fly-free. And so we would always dig trench, big holes, and trees would be felled, long trees, fir trees, and one would just sit down to discharge when you wanted to commit a body function. And I was the first man ever to get lumber from the lumber yard. It was the Chinese boat, and we covered the whole lot in, and we made toilets like they used to have in England in the old days, what were completely unboxed in, and holes cut for men to sit on, and also a little cap to put back on in wood to put back in the hole. And then men were designated to clean out every day, which we did with pulling a big plank across, clean it out, and the cranes would come and take away the night soil. They thought it were absolutely horrendous. They had never seen a urinal stall. I made a urinal stall from corrugated iron sheets, brain it flat with stones and bits of wood, and I took a dry pit, filled it with holes, filled it with bricks, and then covered it over with soil, and it drained away naturally. Well, it only worked in the summer months, but at least it worked. And men would use this urinal stall. The Chinese thought it was quite revolutionary. But then we were dealing with a peasant population.
Did they discriminate between the different nationalities of POW?
No, they tried to make a lot of bones with the American coloured men. They didn't survive very well, but and talked about persecution a lot on the coloured part, but it just didn't happen. It was completely unnecessary. There was not the discrimination that they thought there was. And if there had been, the coloured men wouldn't talk about it.
Did they discriminate between Americans and British? Or
not whatsoever, no. We were segregated in as much that we weren't allowed to mix. They didn't like mixing except at Christmas time. They allowed us to move freely between each company. Apart from that, there was just no point.
Any memories of Turkish or other POWs?
Well, they took the Turkish men away because they had a problem with the Turks in as much that there was no Chinaman who could speak Chinese and Turkish. But there was a Chinaman who could speak Chinese and Russian, and a Russian who could speak Russian and Turkish. So to convert, he had to be done three times. And the Chinese, the Turkish men were taken up to Pak Tong, and there was 150 in total, and they were the only men that grew stronger on the food and never, ever lost a man. Never lost a man.
Can you tell me how you came to be released as a POW?
Yes, I can, yeah. Yes, it was quite some experience. When the war was over, we was informed the war was over at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. On the Monday of the 27th, I always remember that on the Sunday night of the 26th, we watched a total eclipse of the moon, which was quite some experience. I'd never seen a total eclipse of the moon before, but our instructor, Chinese instructor by the name of Lu, he was an astronomer, and he used to show us the Hunter and show us many astronomical features. And we watched the total eclipse of the moon. On the following morning, we had no idea that the end of the war was imminent. At 9:30 that morning, we'd been overflown by Sabre jets heading for Sinanju, which was a city about 40 miles away. It was constantly, every daily, under bombardment. I was told to tell the men and the men in my immediate squad to be on parade for 2 o'clock. We were going down to the major parade ground, and we walked down for 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Every man, Jack, cooks and everybody were on parade that day.